I'm Lisa Labas, host of the Rundown podcast, and I'm here to make your daily news habit a little easier and quicker. In less than 10 minutes, we run through Chicago's top headlines so you can pick out what piques your interest and explore it later on WBEZ. And you can get a taste of what else is going on around Chicago. Listen every weekday wherever you get your podcasts. Breakdown of the top stories of the day in the Chicago area later in this episode. But first, there's been a spotlight on segregation and housing inequality here in Chicago for decades, and the impact of some discriminatory policies is still shaping everyday life for many Black residents. The data in a new report from the Chicago Urban League illustrates that reality, and it shows just how wide the racial wealth gap has remained over the years. So as we mark 60 years since Martin Luther King Jr. announced the Chicago Freedom Movement, a campaign against slum conditions in Chicago, we ask, how have things improved for Black Chicagoans since then? At the table was Pamela Stalling, Vice President of Housing and Financial Empowerment for the Chicago Urban League. Alden Lowry, WBEZ's Data Project's Senior Editor and Chicago Sun-Times columnist. And David Stovall, Professor of Black Studies at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Professor Stovall kicked things off with a clearer picture of the mission behind the Chicago Freedom Movement. Here he is.
So the Chicago Freedom Movement was a collection of Chicago-based and members from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference who came to Chicago specifically to look at fair housing. Mm-hmm. And particularly in North Lawndale, where families were not allowed to purchase homes with what we would consider to be a traditional 15 or 30-year mortgage, where there was an expansive use of what was called land contract leases. And in those land contract leases, you would have a arrangement that was sort of a rent-to-own relationship. Mm-hmm. So you could actually have this contract lease. But if any time you defaulted on that contract lease, your home, lease could be taken away, and you would lose the home. It also had high interest rates. So if you had that, if you had purchased that home on that contract lease, the interest rates were so high that it would be hard to repair it. Mm. So when you talk about distressed communities, look no further than these financial arrangements that make houses difficult to repair because you're paying so much in relationship to what you're making in terms of income.
So with that being sort of the playing field that we were on, I mean, what were the demands then?
The demands were to actually have mortgages for families and for renters to be able to hold landlords accountable. Mm. So this was these were key components because 30 years earlier, you had the slum clearance campaign by the Department of Housing and Urban Development that was here in Chicago that built some of the low-rise public housing units like Ida B. Wells, Lathrop Homes, and the Jane Addams Homes. But those spaces at that time were largely reserved, except for Ida B. Wells, for white residents. Mm. So this piece was to bring it back and to say, we need that same type of accountability. We need these spaces cleared, but also repaired and upkept according to the standards that the residents were demanding.
So, Pam, you know, we talk about better mortgages and making things more fair for renters. Which of these issues that the professor just laid out for us are still unresolved today?
Definitely they're unresolved today. And if you know what the market rate for rent now is, it's more than a mortgage. Sometimes it could be. So looking at that landscape and looking at to where we're at today doesn't seem like we've gotten that far.
Yeah, I mean, what was the housing stock like, Alden? I mean, and affordability. Paint the picture for us, for Black Chicagoans in the 60s.
I mean, I think as the professor was saying, I mean, it was not good. You had folks, whether they were in those situations where they were attempting to, you know, own a piece of property or they were renting, they were largely paying a higher share of their income than their counterparts in other parts of the city. And those things are still in place today. It's interesting. The land contracts are gone. But from the 60s through today, we're talking about in the 1980s and the 1990s, you had a lower percentage of African Americans being able to actually secure a mortgage. It won the right to get them, but we're getting them less often than their white counterparts, often with the same income and job status and things of that nature. We move into the 2000s, and we see the birth of kind of like the subprime mortgage industry really blowing up. At one time, you had subprime lenders, but then by the 2000s, you had mainstream companies that had done, you know, created their offshoot companies that were doing nothing but subprime mortgages. And a lot of their lending, they would just push to in black spaces. They were pushing to those those outfits. And so, again, you had people getting a mortgage but paying very high interest rates. Oftentimes having the same kind of financial chops, if you will, that their white counterparts had, but they weren't getting the same kinds of deals.
Wow.
That leads to the everything that we saw with the Great Recession. And in the aftermath of that, you've got properties in black communities that just literally fell through the floor in terms of what their resale value was in the midst of all of that stuff. I mean, one of the interesting things that's happening in North Lawndale now is that you've got these essentially record property tax increases that are happening because that community and, you know, Inglewood and a few others that also saw very large property tax increases were finally getting assessments. You know, they were kind of catching up. They were finally kind of seeing the recovery.
It's primarily the South and West sides.
Right. And so so now those properties are coming back to the value that they probably should have been years ago. And you got folks who are now getting hit with these big property tax increases who are now going to be, you know, in danger, particularly older folks, going to be in danger of potentially losing those homes because of the fact that they may not be able to pay those property taxes. And so it's interesting. You had people who could have defaulted on a land contract lease in the 1960s that could lose their home with one mistake. And now you've got folks who maybe have been in homes for decades in the same neighborhood who could lose their home now because they can't afford their property taxes. So it's interesting. As much as we've seen change and some would say even progress in many ways, many of the struggles that families were dealing with in North Lawndale and some other black communities, they're still struggling with those same issues.
They definitely remain. And just to piggyback off that, Pamela, I mean, and focusing on the 2025 Black Wealth Report that came out from the Urban League, big picture, I mean, how better off are black Chicagoans today from 1966?
It doesn't seem like much from just what the statistics show, and statistics are statistics. We're still looking at higher taxes when we talk about affordable homes, because we at the League in Housing and Financial Empowerment, we can teach home ownership all day. But if you can't afford a home, then, you know, it's not attainable. So we do have to look at some laws or something to be put in place. When you talk about the Fair Housing Act, you know, it was looking at discriminatory acts. But now I just think it's just a different name now. You know, it's the same game, but just a different name. And we really have to pay attention to what's going on around us.
Hey, if you just got here, welcome. This is In the Loop. I'm your host, Sasha Ann Simons. And we're talking about the housing stock and affordability for black Chicagoans 60 years on from Martin Luther King Jr.'s Chicago Freedom Movement. In the studio, we've got Pamela Stalling, who's vice president of housing and financial empowerment for the Chicago Urban League. Alden Lowry is here, WBEZ's Data Projects senior editor, and David Stovall, who's professor of black studies at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Professor, you've got a book out. It's a new book. It's about how state policy displaces as well as isolates the black community. It's called Engineered Conflict. Tell us more about that title and what exactly it means.
So when we talk about violence in a city like Chicago, I think it becomes important to say, what is violence connected to? So when we talk about what violence is connected to, we have to think about the things that people have been denied access to, like schooling, housing, mm-hmm. and then the way in which law enforcement responds to those people being left out of access to those things. So if we think about, and it's a very basic question that I'm asking in the book around, can a city make you fight? Well, if you don't have any place to live, if you don't have a viable place to go to learn, and you don't have health care, and you don't have viable employment, there's the larger chance that you will be in conflict before you are actually engaging in things that will support your well-being.
I mean, you're fighting for your life.
Period.
In a lot of cases.
So this thing around this engineered conflict is asking, well, who is engineering it and for what purpose? And since 1966 and since the arrival of Black people to Chicago in the mid-19th century, there's always been this contestation around who can live where, mm-hmm. under what conditions, and now what will be done to them because we do not want them to live in those spaces.
Relatedly, you talk a lot about the Chicago Housing Authority and how over time the agency sort of abandoned its mandate to provide affordable housing, and it became one instead that neglected the people who needed it the most. Mm-hmm. How did things get that way?
You have to look at two people in particular, Elizabeth Wood and Robert Taylor. So Elizabeth Wood was the first chairman of the Chicago Housing Authority, and she actually talked about, she called the building of high-rise public housing the end of public housing as we know it. Robert Taylor was the chairman of the board of the Chicago Housing Authority, who also did not approve of high-rise housing because they knew it was cheaply made and they did not have the financial means to repair it. Mm. So as Robert Taylor was really stressed about this particular thing, when he passed, the Chicago Housing Authority literally named the Robert Taylor homes after him in a space that he did not approve of. So now when we think about that high-rise public housing, it was never meant to do right by people. And somebody who's been on the show, Dee Bradford Hunt, who's at Loyola, he often talked about structurally these places were never intended to last long or to even be repaired long term. So when you talk about how do things get this way, it was done on the cheap. And it was done on the cheap with a population of people who were thought as disposable. Mm. So now you can engineer conflict with that grouping of people because they are already thought to be disposable.
I want to talk about the geography a little bit with you, Alden, because we talk about Black Chicago. It looks different today than it did 60 years ago, right?
It does. I mean,
like, where is Black Chicago today versus where we used to be?
You saw some shifts. So Black Chicago is still kind of, I will say, in its infancy, because Black Chicago has been, we think to the historic Bronzeville neighborhood, the Black Belt, in the aftermath of the Great Migration, the first wave of it, at least during the early years of that, you know, kind of forming in 1920. And back then, it was literally a very small strip. I might get the boundaries a little bit off, but think from State Street to King Drive today, mm-hmm. from about maybe 26th Street, where the Great Migration statue is, down to about maybe 47th, I want to say.
I think you're right. The professor's nodding.
And so we stretched a little, Black Chicago stretched a little farther south. It stretched a little farther east. It wasn't stretching west yet, but it stretched east some. And then you saw some just small pockets but developing on the west side and the far south side, as far back as maybe in the early 1940s. But still, the heart of it was kind of that expanding Black Belt. Then the restrictive covenants fell in 1948, and then essentially all hell broke loose, for lack of a better way of saying it. So Black people were then essentially allowed to move to all other parts of town. And so we saw the development of the west side. We saw the development, very rapid development of the south side. And so by the 1960s, I think kind of the base of what we know of today as the West Side was formed. And we're talking about like the near West Side, Garfield Park, East and West Garfield Park, North Lawndale, Austin, maybe a little bit of Humboldt Park. And then South Side, we're talking about pretty much think we hadn't really gone farther west yet past maybe Halsted or maybe Racine, somewhere around there. Some of that came in the 1970s and 1980s. So Black Chicago grew from the 1960s, I would say, in its height, maybe around 1990. Today, it has shrunk. Not only the overall population of Black Chicago has shrunk, but the footprint of Black Chicago has shrunk. So think about the near South Side. Think about the near West Side. Mm-hmm. Think about the neighborhood that used to surround Cabrini Green. Think about
Bronzeville.
Think about Bronzeville.
It's not bronze anymore.
It's not as bronze as it was. I think there's one census tract in Bronzeville that has actually lost its Black majority. It was the first time in, I want to say, maybe six decades or so that the Bronzeville census tract has not been majority Black. But the near South Side, what we know of as the South Loop, you know, pretty much stretching from, I would say, maybe from Roosevelt all the way down to 22nd Street, that was actually a Black neighborhood and had been for a long time. There weren't a lot of people there because it wasn't as built up. But, I mean, the historic Second Ward that Oscar DePriest was the first Black alderman in Chicago, that was the heart of that ward. Madeline Hathcock in the 1990s was the alderman there before she lost to Bob Fioretti. And then to spite Bob Fioretti, they really remapped the Second Ward completely different.
Yes.
But anyway, you know, those were Black spaces. The near West Side, where the Rockwell Gardens development was, where Henry Horner Homes was, you know, those were Black neighborhoods. And today they're no longer Black neighborhoods. I mean, there's a faint presence of Black folks in those neighborhoods now. So all of that is around housing, all of that is around development, all of that is around what the private market was willing to spend and do and what they weren't. And they weren't when those were Black spaces. And as that Black population just, you know, declined in those areas,
right,
that's when we start seeing the growth.
And it impacts everything, right? It impacts education, the schools that our kids would go to, employment, income, right? How much money we were able to make, how far ahead we would get. How does it feel then? I want to hear from all of you real quick to know that with all of this that we've just discussed, during this Trump administration, there have been significant policy shifts to roll back the Fair Housing Act.
Well, I mean, firstly, when you talk about that rollback of the Fair Housing Act, I think this is something that, you know, people always talk about history never repeats itself, but it sometimes rhymes, right? This is this moment of rhyming, right? So this is a moment where you will now have less Black people having access to fair housing, access to quality education, access to living wage employment, because things around housing in particular is to understand what housing is connecting to. Mm-hmm. So a good friend of mine always says, you always have to think about housing as an education issue because education is a housing issue, right? They are never separate. And now when you think about the rollbacks to the Fair Housing Act, you now have to think about, well, who will have access to those things that were guaranteed federally.
And does this feel like the federal government is sort of reducing accountability for segregation and discrimination?
Right. They have totally lifted their hands of the claim or the guilt around them fostering segregation.
So, Pamela, you say that the only way that we'll ever see real change is by changing policy. I want to hear more on that.
Definitely. In the state of Black Chicago, we do have some recommendations regarding policy change. Low interest mortgage and down payment assistance. You know, we want to keep hammering that down because it does help our Black and brown consumers. Equitable lending and credit reform. We have to look at things different now. The way we used to look at credit, you know, we have to change the way because we have more entrepreneurs, you know, that's in that Black space. And then tenant to owner transition programs. Those are still good, but it seems like they're doing away with the housing choice vouchers. They're making it harder. So not only do we have to face the limited stock that we have, but we also just have to look at the affordability because now you have taxes that's playing into part. So when we teach home ownership, we look at your mortgage and your taxes and your insurance. And when you have all of that going against you, we're still saying home ownership is attainable, but at what cost is it attainable? I could get you in a house, but can I get you to stay in that house? You know, I could teach you all day, but the issue is you really have to educate people on, okay, is it a great time to buy? It's not just because of the interest rates, but we have to look at, is it affordable? Because what do we know? Every year taxes go up.
Right. And that home ownership process, it's tricky. I mean, there are a lot of people that don't understand how that works, right? I'm putting myself in that equation. I had to learn. I'm still learning, if I can be honest. I'm still learning. And there are, as you pointed out, Pam, there are times to do this and times not to. And I find that a lot of Black people are not always aware, you know, just from conversations that I've had. I feel like we need more seminars, just more.
And we definitely have them every month.
You do. Okay. And are they full? Are people showing up?
Yes. We're doing everything through Zoom. So we have an average of 30 people. And it's an 8-hour class. So yeah. We just
There's
have
a lot
one
to
yesterday.
Learn.
It's a lot to learn. So it's not just, okay, I got to get my credit score up or I have to have this much saved. It is much more to the home buying process. And if you purchased a home 20 years ago, it's different from purchasing
that's
today.
That's right. And that's so what I'm getting
all
to.
You constantly have to educate yourself just on that process. Mm-hmm. But just when you think about wealth building, that's the first way people gain wealth, mm-hmm. you know, is through home ownership. But when that's stripped away, then you don't have anything
I
to
build
upon. I want
to see more of that in our community. Any thoughts, Alden, as you hear some of those solutions, as someone who covers this and really crunches the numbers here on the racial wealth gap?
Yeah, I mean, those are sound strategies. Yeah. The thing I would just say, and not to be the devil's advocate, but just the experience for Black folks is different than it is for others. And
yes.
So even when you follow those same steps, you may not see the return that others may see. The market may not respond to your home and your situation the way it might with others. There have been studies, we've done stories about them. Appraisers go into a home with Black pictures on the wall and everything. They give it a certain dollar value.
Yeah.
They go back into the same space with none of that or with white faces on the wall, and they appraise the property at a higher value. So there's still the structural kind of inequity that has an impact. But yes, indeed.
Gosh, every step forward, I feel like there's a barrier.
Yeah.
Every step forward.
And that's part of education, because we talk about what is an appraiser? You know, what's the difference between an appraiser? What's the difference between an inspector? You
right.
know, people don't understand the different factors. Mm-hmm. People don't understand you need to get an attorney. You know, so those processes. And then what mm-hmm. do they do? And what do they do for you? Because it's a lot of information, and that's how come you don't need to take this lightly, because this is probably the biggest and the most expensive investment you'll ever make.
Absolutely.
So you have to make sure you understand each step, and not just, you know, everybody is Googling stuff now, you know, find out, because just like he said, everything is cultural. So everything
right.
is not, my experience is not going to be your experience.
Yeah.
I don't exactly know exactly how much you spend on hair as opposed to, so then we got to do budgeting, you know, mm-hmm. then we got to go through financial literacy.
Right.
And that's why I said it is not a cookie cutter to this process. But when you're looking at home ownership, that is a pathway to mm-hmm. wealth. So when we talk about, you know, how much wealth we have in the Black community, we got to look at that home ownership rate.
I'll give you a very quick final word, Professor, here on where we should move forward to.
Yeah, we have to. Everything that people talked about, I think, is absolutely right. And we also have to look at where folks are still allowed to live. Right. Because in Chicago, we see a shifting city, and we also see a city that Eve Ewing always talks about. Chicago has begun to de-blacken itself. Right. So they since 1980, over 350,000 Black people have left Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have to think about, so where are those spaces where we can actually build with each other, self-determine, and get what we need, because we need it, a different take on equity.
Yes. Professor David Stovall is with the University of Illinois, Chicago. Alden Lowry is WBEZ's Data Project Senior Editor and a Chicago Sun-Times columnist. And Pamela Stalling is Vice President of Housing and Financial Empowerment with the Chicago Urban League. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, now it's time to get into the top local stories of the day. At the table to help me break them down was Claire Lane, WBEZ Morning Edition anchor, Michael Puente, WBEZ Weekend anchor and reporter, and Violet Miller, a Chicago Sun-Times reporter. It's January in Chicago, so yep, you guessed it. We started with some chatter about the weather. Here's Michael, whose car trouble and the cold temperatures kept him from making it to the office yesterday.
Anytime you have this kind of weather, this colder temps, whatever problem you have in the car, it's going to bring it out.
Oh, yes.
It's just, so I said, why take the risk?
It magnifies car trouble. It sure does. So, Claire, how are things for you? You start a little earlier than the rest of us.
I do. I start in the dead of night, some might say. And National Weather Service was predicting a couple of bands of storms to come. Snow showers, really. And we got a light dusting, if you will, on the north side of the city. And then that was it. And then we got a few more flurries about an hour ago. We are going to have some evening snow showers. National Weather Service is not to expect any more than an inch. And then comes the cold.
Yes.
The deep cold.
An extreme cold watch is in effect for tomorrow and for Friday. This is where wind chills can be as cold as 35 below zero.
Yeah, that's going to be during the overnight hours. And waking up Friday, the high is zero. So it's sort of like which side of the fence are you on that day?
Yeah. Are you prepared with your layers?
It's important too, if you're driving, put gloves in your car. Put a blanket in your trunk just for peace of mind. You never know.
I literally just started doing that.
And for those looking for warming shelters earlier this week, Cook County opened its courthouses. The city expanded warming center hours at its different, centers. So we could probably see that again this weekend, especially with the anticipated cold.
Yes, absolutely.
I was just going to say, have those hand warmers, those feet warmers. They work magically. You know, put them in your pocket and they keep you pretty warm.
Those little heating pads.
Oh, absolutely.
Hands. Yeah, those are good. Now, Claire, you've got an update. Switching gears here. This is on the speculation we talked about yesterday. Chicago might buy back parking meters, but it sounds like it's a no-go.
Yeah, and this is pretty official as far as we know. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson says the city will not, in fact, buy back Chicago's parking meters that were sold off during a now infamous 75-year contract deal back in 2008.
Yeah.
So Johnson's comments follow days of speculation. Will he, won't he, will the city or not, over this deal that his financial team said they were exploring it. And then the comment sections just kind of blew up, especially here in the newsroom. But ultimately, the financial team determined that the final purchase price to get this contract back would be far too high and much more than the initially received for sale offer.
So Mayor Johnson reversed course. Yeah, he said, I didn't want to make a bad deal worse.
Yeah, he said he didn't like the optics.
That's pretty valid. All right. Violet, in other news, a jury has been sworn in for the trial of the man who's accused of putting a bounty on the head of U.S. Border Patrol Commander Greg Bovino. And there seems to be a sort of key detail that prosecutors actually won't be able to use in the case.
Yeah, so federal prosecutors have actually had a number of setbacks in the last week. The judge in that case barring any attempt to connect him to gang activity after federal prosecutors said that they wouldn't be able to prove that he was a member of these gangs. Other evidence was tossed out along with texts, videos that federal prosecutors had brought. So again, lots of setbacks for them. But what we can expect, Bovino won't be taking the stand. There is an anonymous source on the federal side that, is allegedly tied to this Snapchat that is, kind of the center of the case where this quote unquote murder for hire situation came from.
Yeah. And so opening statements in the trial are set to begin today, right?
Yes. Yeah. So that is getting underway today. And like I said, Bovino won't be taking the stand in that case. But we could see some other witnesses that, might bring some clarity to the situation.
Yeah. Michael, there's a possible ICE facility in Merrillville, Northwest Indiana. What's going on there and what are local leaders saying about it?
Well, this started 3 weeks ago when a report came out from the Washington Post that showed sort of a list of potential sites throughout the country. And lo and behold, Merrillville, Indiana is on there. Merrillville has just had an explosion of these supersize Amazon warehouse type facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And people are thinking ICE is going to want to convert at least one facility into a holding center. The town of Merrillville is saying, we haven't had any communication with ICE or Border Patrol about this with the federal government. So it seems like the town is being left in the dark. Some people are saying, well, maybe the town doesn't need to be consulted on this. But if you're talking about zoning laws, if you're talking, I mean, these warehouses are zoned for business. They're not zoned for prisons and detention facilities. And what's that going to do in terms of the environment and property values? I'm a taxpayer in Northwest Indiana in this area. What's that going to do to my home values? So I have a little bit personal stake in this thing. But at the same time, is this par for the course? We're just not getting information from the federal government on something as important as this. And who wants to be known as this sort of prison facility concentration camp type thing?
Yeah. Hey, if you just got here, welcome. This is In the Loop. I'm your host, Sasha Ann Simons, and we're going behind the headlines and telling you the stories that you need to know today in the Chicago area with WBEZ's Claire Lane and Michael Puente and Violet Miller from the Chicago Sun-Times. Now, Violet, Lurie Children's Hospital seems to be pulling back trans health care for some patients. Again, because I believe you've reported on this before. Tell me what's new today.
Yeah, getting a little bit of deja vu. Just about this time last year, Trump was signing executive orders that, you know, many groups said were just intended to intimidate hospitals, as no enforcement was ever made, no court ruling, nothing like that. But Lurie Children's last year stopped surgeries for any patients under 19 years old. So that included 18 and 19 year olds who, you know, are legal adults. They were referred to Northwestern, who then did the same thing and canceled their surgeries then. So now we're looking at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has recommended Lurie's, along with five other hospitals in Democratic cities and states, for investigation by the HHS Office of Investigations. And so, you know, Lurie said that they're, in response to this, not going to be giving prescriptions to new patients under 18 years old, even if they're coming from other hospitals where they had previously been prescribed those things.
And they're doing this because of the federal threats?
And they said explicitly in a statement to us that they're doing this because of the federal threats.
How are local trans rights groups reacting? Anything so far?
Yeah, Trans Up Front Illinois, they're one of the groups that actually stepped in last summer when a lot of these hospitals were canceling care for patients to connect patients to private providers, which can be more expensive, but still provide the care with, you know, less leverage from the federal government on their funding. So they said this is, you know, an early capitulation that, again, there's been no court ruling. There's no actual definitive thing that the government is just threatening an investigation again, which Attorney General Kwame Raoul actually sued the federal government about last year, saying that they were trying to intimidate hospitals with these investigations.
Wow. Michael, rideshare drivers gathered in the Loop yesterday. This is in support of a landmark bill filed in Springfield. What are the details?
Well, the Illinois Drivers Alliance legislation would allow drivers to sort of form sort of a sort of have union, a union and collective bargaining for Uber and Lyft to give them some more rights. It wouldn't, they wouldn't be forming a, I guess it, the legislation is a little confusing, but it would sort of be on a nationwide basis to give them more protections. I think that's just the bottom line of this. You have a lot of Uber and rideshare drivers who are subject to, you know, not the safest conditions and also having, you know, wages. So this would give them a little bit leg up in dealing with such companies.
Yeah. And I mean, what else needs to happen now for drivers to get closer to unionizing?
Well, this is sponsored. This is not going to be taken down to Springfield, and it's going to go through the legislative process just like any other bill that I have hearings if it will make it that far. And now, you know, we'll see where it goes from there.
Yeah, if the bill becomes law, the story says the Illinois Drivers Alliance would be required to get 10% of active rideshare drivers to sign these union cards. It'd be interesting to follow that and see what happens.
It would be interesting to see if it actually makes it out of this session.
Sticking with Springfield, Claire, the Illinois House Speaker, Chris Welch, he's weighing in on the Chicago Bears staying in Chicago.
That's right.
He says, never-ending topic.
And it's ongoing. He says he's hopeful at this point that the state legislator will keep the Bears here in Illinois. This comes, as we know, as the team continues to mull over their move to Northwest Indiana territory of the Michael Puente. But Welch says in the conversations that he's had with Bears brass that the team is no longer looking for that $1 billion check from the state that they had initially asked for to help build this new mega stadium instead. They're doing some classic wheeling and dealing, seeking some state infrastructure dollars, help on legislation potentially that would provide property tax breaks for the site in Arlington Heights. And if you were on social media, Illinois House Speaker Chris Welch was at the game Sunday, posted some pics of himself with George McCaskey, Bears owner, and President Kevin Warren. So he's rubbing shoulders, and he's trying to make it known that the Bears should stay in Illinois, according to
him. Sasha, I got to say this. This is a kind of a tricky time for the Chicago Bears and the state of Illinois because Indiana state legislatures, they are in session right now. They normally don't have a special session. So this is their time between now and April, and they're formalizing packages right now. So if they get a package together, that is, I still think it's a long shot for Northwest Indiana to land the, a stadium. But if they put that package together, the Bears are going to look at it and be like, "Yo,
the timing is might be intentional." Yeah.
It might be.
Well, the thing people often forget about is the Gary Airport, which has a lot of draw, has a lot of incentive for things like sports teams flying in town for and a potential game.
It would not be the first time the stadium that you see right here on the lake, the spaceship by Soldier Field, that design looks very similar to Planet Park that they proposed for Gary, what, 20, 30 years ago?
Years ago, yeah. What else are you looking out for, Claire?
Well, we've got some more sports news, but it's sort of taking her talents from the court to the screen. Chicago Sky forward Angel Reese is doing that. She will be featured in the next season of Netflix's The Hunting Wives.
Okay. From the court to the runway to the screen.
She was in the Victoria's Secret fashion show.
Exactly.
She's a two-time WNBA star, this we know, but it's the second season of Hunting Wives. It's in production, but the release date has yet to be announced.
Oh, I can't wait to see that.
She's making all kinds of moves.
Making all kinds of moves. You go, Angel. Now, Violet, as Minneapolis is seeing this wave of federal agents, just like Chicago did a few months ago, Chicagoans are banding together right now, and they're sending, sometimes even hand-delivering some aid to the Twin Cities. Tell us more.
Yeah, so this week I spoke to a few folks who have managed just between a few people to send 150,000 whistles around the country to cities as big as New York City and as small as towns of 10,000.
Wait, where do you even find 150,000 whistles?
Well, that was the trouble they ran into. You can only order so many from Amazon, and they started bumping up the prices when people started buying these in bulk. So people turned to 3D printing. You know, some folks realized they could be making as many as 800 whistles with one roll of filament, which, you know, can retail for as low as $12, which is the price of about 50 whistles, the last I checked on Amazon. So, you know, it's been pretty easy when they get these networks together, just a, you know, kind of ad hoc group of people that are all looking to do this together and send resources.
Yeah, no, it's interesting just to watch this, the sense of camaraderie between states. And it feels like we are sort of at the forefront of that, really helping to drive that.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of organizers are crediting that unity and the consistency in like response tactics to the success. Folks being able to like de-arrest people in, you know, obviously the most major of cases, but in other cases just document and kind of drive federal agents out of areas. But, you know, Chicago learned from LA. That's what organizers were telling me. Minneapolis is learning from Chicago. And, you know, whatever city is next is being encouraged to reach out to organizers here because they say that's how they learned and that's how Chicago fared the way it did.
Goodness, what a time to be alive, folks.
You could teach people how to whistle.
Yes. There's
whistle
that.
Loud.
There's that too.
That's free.
Now, Michael, O'Hare Airport, it's back to being number one.
We're number one.
It's dethroned Atlanta's airport. Can you believe this? As the country's busiest. I mean, what do you think about that? I never thought it was possible to dethrone Hartsfield-Jackson because that airport is insanely busy.
Never underestimate Chicago.
There
you go, Sasha. Underestimating Chicago. Yes, it's the first time since 2019. O'Hare had 857,000 aircraft landing and takeoffs in 2025 to surpass Hartsfield-Jackson Airport in Atlanta. So that's a lot. But, you know, so where do you do you like O'Hare? Do you like that big, busy airport or Midway?
Yeah. Let's see. Am I team O'Hare or team Midway? I'm team cheapest.
Yes.
Cheapest flight. Okay. Just get me there. O'Hare is a pain to get to right now, especially with all that construction. I will say that. But I've done a few recent O'Hare flights that were like super early in the morning, so it wasn't too much of a bother to get up there. But
right.
I'm wherever the bargains are.
I've always been fascinated with O'Hare, the size of it, the number of people who work there. But in terms of just easy access, Midway is really the way to go.
What do you think? Settle the tie here.
I don't think I've flown in maybe 4 or 5 years, so my vote is going to be for the Amtrak. I love me some Yes.
There you go.
That's right.
WBEZ's Claire Lane and Michael Puente and Violet Miller from the Sun-Times.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Sienna Greaves, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll join us for more. We drop a new episode about Chicago news and culture every weekday afternoon, including our weekly news recap on Fridays, and once a month, Ask the Mayor. Thanks for listening and have a great day.